For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
We're going to conclude our study of Genesis this morning by studying the life of Joseph. Joseph, who was the great-grandson of Abraham and the son of Jacob, who we studied last week, and who was the father of what became one of the 12 tribes of Israel. The story of Joseph takes place in the 1800s BC. We noted last week that in narrative, in stories, perhaps the key to a good story is tension within the story, tension between characters, tension between people and circumstances, tension that drives the plot to a climax which resolves the tension. And the tension in the story of Joseph is the conflict and alienation between Joseph and his 10 other half-brothers. And we'll see how that works itself out here in just a moment. It's a long passage. Last week, we covered 8 chapters of Genesis in the story of Jacob. We're going to try to cover 14 chapters in the study of Joseph. And so it's set up as a setting. We'll read through the setting, which describes the origin of this tension between Joseph and his brothers, then a long main narrative section reaching a climax in chapter 45, and then an epilogue in the final 4 chapters of this story. So I'm going to ask you to listen carefully, because I'm going to tell most of this story, just read certain key passages as we try to work right through it and leave time then for some reflection on some of the lessons that this story teaches all of us. Okay, so the setting, we'll read it. This is the account of Jacob and his family when Joseph, again, who was one of his second to last son, was 17 years old. He often tended his father's flocks. He worked for his half-brothers, the other 10 brothers. But Joseph reported to his father some of the bad things his brothers were doing. And there was the fact that Jacob loved Joseph more than any of his other children because Joseph had been born to him in his old age. And so one day Jacob had a special gift made for Joseph, a beautiful robe. But his brothers hated Joseph because their father loved him more than the rest of them. They couldn't even say one kind word to him. So there's the tension, right? You got a dysfunctional family, a father who shows overt favoritism to one of his kids, brothers who are resentful toward their father. It's coming out sideways toward Joseph. That's the origin of the tension. The tension increases. One night, Joseph had a dream. And when he told his brothers about it, they hated him more than ever. "Listen to this dream," he said. "We were all out in the field tying up bundles of grain, and suddenly my bundle stood up, and all your bundles gathered around and bowed low before mine." I think the best interpretation of this is youthful naivete. Maybe it's conceit. We don't know. His brothers responded, "So you think you'll be our king, do you? Do you actually think you'll reign over us?" And they hated him all the more because of his dreams and the way he talked about them. Soon Joseph had another dream. And again he told his brothers about it. "Listen, I've had another dream. The sun and the moon and the 11 stars." The 11th would be Benjamin, who would be born younger than Joseph. "And 11 stars bowed low before me." And this time he told the dream to his father as well as his brothers. But his father scolded him. "What kind of dream is that?" he asked. "Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow to the ground before you?" But while his brothers were jealous of Joseph because of the dream, his father Jacob at least wondered what those dreams meant. Of course, Jacob himself had dreams from God which were prophetic in nature. So he at least has a category for this. And so he ponders it. And that's going to lead us to then the main narrative. One day, Jacob sends the 10 half-brothers out for a long grazing mission with their flocks. And when they're late coming back, he sends Joseph out to find them. He knows they tend to be lazy, so he sends the spoiled brat, younger brother, out to check on them. And they see him when he finally catches up to them. They see him coming toward them across this big field, and they recognize him because of his beautiful robe. And they decide, you know what? We're going to resolve this tension. We're going to get rid of him. We're going to kill him. I'm going to rub him out, and he will be gone, and then life will be good. And none of us have ever reached that conclusion when we're in conflict with people, that the key is just to get rid of them, right? Judah, one of the brothers, says, dude, that would be a little extreme. Why don't we just sell him into slavery instead? And we'll make a little bit of money from selling him into slavery. And so that's what they do. They throw him down in a pit. They wait until some traders are coming down the interstate toward Egypt, and they flag him down. They say, how'd you like to buy this guy? He'd make a good slave in Egypt. And they said, that's good. They pay him for Joseph, and they take him off to Egypt. They cover their tracks by dipping Joseph's beautiful robe in animal blood, and they just bring it back with them to Jacob. They don't lie to him outright. They just say, hey, look what we found. What do you think? And they let Jacob draw the conclusion that he'd been killed by a wild beast. There's some legalistic thinking there too, right? I'm sure they thought, we didn't actually lie to Dad, right? Dad concluded this and we didn't correct him. And so the tension seems to be resolved because the brothers and Joseph are parted. The next chapter, chapter 38, seems like a detour. It's a chapter in which the 10 older brothers begin to intermarry with Canaanite women, which was expressly forbidden by God, because God's plan was to keep Jacob's family and their descendants separate and form their own nation, and then at the right time to bring from that nation the rest of the Bible and also the Messiah. But the brothers, even though they know this, they begin to intermarry with other Canaanite people, and the threat of assimilation of his family is very dire. And just hold that in RAM, because that's going to come back up later, because God has a plan to preserve his people from assimilation. Well, meanwhile, the traders take Joseph down to Egypt and they sell him on the slave market, and a man named Potiphar, who was a military aristocrat, buys him and puts him in, makes him one of his house slaves. But we read that God was with him, and he began early on to demonstrate a certain administrative skill, which Potiphar notices. And very quickly, evidently, Potiphar promotes him to be the head household slave. And that becomes Joseph's life for the next decade, being the head house slave for Potiphar. At the end of that period of time, and maybe before, Potiphar's wife, unnamed, gets a bad case of the hots for Joseph. And she comes on to him really obviously. If you ever read this passage, it's like real subtle. She says, lie with me. And he says, you know, how could your husband, my master, has been good to me all these years. How could I sin against him and against God by doing something like this? So he tells her to drop it. He eventually flees, and she grabs his robe as he flees. And as the wrath of this woman scorned works itself out, she tells her husband that Joseph tried to rape her. And Potiphar, you know, he doesn't evidently investigate the matter. He just throws Joseph in jail, which he could do because slaves had no legal rights. There was no trial. He just threw him in this dungeon. And Egyptian dungeons were really terrible places where people went to rot and to die. And so Joseph, now having been sold into slavery, now he winds up in jail. Neither time was it his fault. But once again, it says God was with him, and he demonstrates again some administrative skill that so that the jailer thinks, I could have him do most of the work administrating this prison, and I can play video games instead. So before you know it, Joseph again is the one running the show, although still a prisoner. Then a couple of Pharaoh's servants, a baker and a cupbearer, and I always confuse which is which, so I'm not even going to try. They wind up being put in jail by Pharaoh. It's not clear what they did to be put in jail by him. You didn't have to do much to be put in jail. If you're the Pharaoh, you can just send anyone to jail. And when they get there, they both have dreams. And they are perplexed about the meaning of their dreams. And Joseph overhears them discussing their dreams. He says, I think God has given me the ability to understand your dreams. And they're like, okay, shoot. And he says to one of them, I forget which one, he says, well, you know, your dream means that, very shortly, your head's going to be lifted up figuratively in the sense that you're going to be let go and restored to your former job. And then he says to the other one, and you very shortly are going to have your head lifted up and put in a noose and hanged. And it says it went down just the way he said. So as the one who's being released is headed back to his job, Joseph says, hey, when you get back into Pharaoh's court, remember me. You know, I helped you get there. Say a good word for me. But it says that when he got back to work and got back to normal life, he forgot all about that. Again, something we can't relate to. He forgets all about his promise to help Joseph, with the result that Joseph languishes in this dungeon for another 2 years. Just wasting his life. And then Pharaoh has a dream, and it really disturbs him. It's a dream about 7 fat cows and 7 starving cows. And he's perplexed about what it means. He asks people, you know, in his court, no one seems to know. And that jogs the memory of the dude who was in jail with Joseph. He says, I know someone who interpreted my dream. And Pharaoh's like, well, have him brought here immediately. I want to see what he has to say about this dream. So he brings Joseph before him, and Joseph, you know, says, God's the one really who interprets dreams. He gives prophetic dreams and he interprets their meaning. But I think God's enabled me to know what this dream means. And he goes on to tell Pharaoh the 7 fat cows represent the next 7 years, which are going to be years of great plenty agriculturally for this whole area of the world. But the bad news is that those 7 prosperous years are going to be followed by 7 years of famine throughout this same area of the world. And then Joseph goes one step further. He says, my advice to you, Pharaoh, is that you find someone, a great administrator, who can, during these next 7 years of plenty, save up a lot of grain and food so that when the 7 years of famine hit, you'll be in a position to enrich your kingdom, because you can sell your extra grain to not only people who are not Egyptians and make a profit off of them, but you'll even be able to buy up real estate from Egyptians, because what good's their real estate if they starve? You can buy their land from them and consolidate your power. And Pharaoh goes, I think I'm looking at the man who can do that kind of administration. And so in one day, Joseph goes from prison to prime minister over all of Egypt. And it says no one had greater power except for Pharaoh himself. And so he spends those next 7 years doing what he said needed to be done, storing up that extra grain. And then the famine hits, just like he said it would. And he begins to deal with people coming who are famine stricken and begins to sell them grain. And that's the setting in which the tension between the brothers resumes. It says that, you know, they're sitting there and their stomachs are grumbling, and Jacob says, well, you know, you knuckleheads, what are you looking at each other for? There's grain down in Egypt. Go buy some, because they're pretty wealthy. So Jacob's sons arrived in Egypt along with others to buy food, for the famine was in Canaan as well. So Joseph was governor over all of Egypt and selling, in charge of selling grain to all the people. And because of that, it was to him that his brothers came, and when they arrived, they bowed before him with their faces to the ground. Fulfillment of Joseph's dream. Joseph recognized his brothers instantly, but apparently they did not recognize him. I mean, after all, they assume he's dead, so that becomes a grid through which you filter the sensory data anyway. They wouldn't be expecting to see him. He's 20 years older. He's dressed like an Egyptian with eyeshadow and a goofy hat. So they don't recognize him. He recognized them, though, instantly, but he pretended to be a stranger. And he spoke harshly to them. "Where are you from?" he demanded. "Well, from the land of Canaan. We've come to buy food. There's actually 12 of us, along with our father, sons of a man living in the land of Canaan. Our younger brother's back there with our father right now. And one of our brothers is no longer with us." No kidding, he's no longer with us. Yeah. And so Joseph says, "I think you're spies. I think you're here representing a wealthy enemy, and I think you're here doing recon on how to exploit our vulnerabilities. And you're going to have to prove to me that you're telling me the truth, that you're just family members. In fact, one of you is going to have to stay here in prison. And you need to go back to your family and get your youngest brother and bring him down here to prove to me that you're telling the truth." Well, speaking among themselves, they said, "Clearly we're being punished because of what we did to Joseph long ago. We saw his anguish when he pleaded for his life, but we wouldn't listen. And that's why we're in this trouble." Of course, they didn't know that Joseph understood them. They're speaking to each other in their native tongue, not knowing that Joseph knows he's raised in that tongue. And they didn't know that he understood them because he'd been speaking to them through an interpreter. Now he turned away from them and began to weep. This skewered his heart so deeply, seeing them, hearing them continue to lie about what they did to him, and then overhearing what they said. When he regained his composure, he spoke to them again. And then he chose Simeon, one of the brothers, from among them and tied him up right before their eyes. "Go home and get your younger brother, or this guy rots in jail." Well, they go back. He gives them just enough food for the trip back and the return trip. He doesn't sell them the massive provisions they offered to buy. And they get back and tell Jacob. And Jacob is absolutely devastated. He said, "You know, one of my sons has been killed by a wild beast. Another one of my sons is in prison now with Pharaoh. And now you're asking me to give you my youngest son. I won't do it. I can't do it. It'll kill me." And they're like, "Well, then we're going to all die of starvation." And he finally relents and says, "Take him down there. Go down and do what you can to get Simeon and bring Benjamin back safe." So they go back down. And when they get to Egypt, surprisingly, they find that Joseph, who they don't know is Joseph, invites them to this lavish dinner at his house, which you just didn't do. The Egyptians were very separatist. They didn't mingle with this. They didn't eat with people who were non-Egyptians. They kept their distance from them. They were conscious of their own separate purity. But he invites them to this dinner. He dines with them. And they're at the dinner, and they gave him the gifts that they brought him. They brought a bunch of gifts to bribe him to giving up Simeon. And then they bowed low to the ground before him once more. And of course, this would be, these gifts are from Jacob. So in a sense, Jacob is bowing down before him as well, fulfillment of dream number two. Then Joseph looked at his brother Benjamin, the son of his own mother. Only Joseph and Benjamin were the sons of Jacob's wife, Rachel. He says, "Is this your youngest brother, the one you told me about? May God be gracious to you, my son." And then Joseph hurried from the room because he was overcome with emotion for his brother. And he went into his private room where he broke down and wept. He comes back out and he loads them up with food, the food that they've asked for. And he sends them, he says, "Go on, you can all go back home." But he secretly puts his favorite silver cup, hides it in Benjamin's suitcase. And once they leave and they're on the interstate north back to Canaan, he sends some of his police to pull them over. They pull the whole family over. They say, you stole from our master. And they're like, "Far be it from us to do anything like that. Search all of our suitcases. You'll see we've got nothing to hide." So they search the suitcases and find the silver cup in Benjamin's suitcase. Cuff them all and bring them back before Joseph. And Joseph's like, "Dudes, you guys are busted. You're just busted. Have you ever been busted? You know what it's like to be busted? It's a real drag. It's a real drag." At this point, he says to them, "I'm keeping Benjamin. I don't know, you guys go do what you need to do, but I'm keeping him because of what you did to me." And it's at this point that Judah was the same one who at least had the integrity to say, "Let's not kill him, let's sell him as a slave." Judah speaks up and says, "We can't go back to our father without Benjamin. If he sees that the boy is not with us, our father will die. We, your servants, will indeed be responsible for sending that grieving, white-haired man to his grave. My Lord, I guaranteed to my father that I would take care of the boy. So please, Lord, let me stay here as a slave instead of the boy." He offers himself as a substitute to bear the wrath of Joseph in Benjamin's place, and let the boy return with his brothers. "For how can I return to my father if the boy is not with me? I couldn't bear to see the anguish this would cause my father." And so this leads to the climax of the story, right here. Joseph could stand it no longer. There were many people in the room, and he said to his attendants, "Out, all of you, get out of here." So he was alone with his brothers when he told them who he was. He told them who he was, then he broke down and wept. He wept and then told them who he was, and then he wept some more so loudly that the Egyptians outside could hear him. Then word of it was carried even to Pharaoh's palace. "I am Joseph," he said to his brothers. "Is my father indeed still alive?" But his brothers were speechless. Can you imagine? What a bust. This is your worst nightmare. They were stunned to realize that Joseph was standing there in front of them. "Please come closer," he said to them. So they inch closer. And he said to them again, "I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into slavery." Yikes. "But don't be upset." Boy, that's a big but, right? "But don't be upset and don't be angry with yourselves for selling me to this place. It was God who sent me here ahead of you to preserve your lives. This famine has ravaged the land for 2 years and it's going to last for 5 more years. God sent me ahead of you to keep you and your families alive and to preserve many survivors. So it was God who sent me here, not you." He means in the last analysis. He said, "You did intend me to be in slavery here, but God's bigger than you are, and God overruled your purpose in sending me here. in favor of his purpose for getting me here. He's the one who's made me an advisor to Pharaoh, the manager of his entire palace and the governor of all Egypt. Now hurry back to my father and tell him, this is what your son Joseph says. God has made me master over all the land of Egypt. So come down to me immediately. And then this climax ends with him weeping now with joy, which implies, of course, that the former weeping, of course, was weeping out of pain over what they had done to him. He embraced Benjamin, and Benjamin did the same. And then Joseph kissed each of his brothers and wept over them. And after that, they began talking freely with them. They got reconciled and began to, probably for the first time in their lives, speak not just civilly to each other, but with love toward each other. And then comes the epilogue, which we'll just survey very briefly. Things get resolved, and then the aftermath narrated by the author is, of course, that Jacob comes down and is reunited with Joseph before he eventually dies, and Joseph fulfills Jacob's wish that when he dies, he be buried back in the promised land, because that's the land that God's going to one day give his descendants. Joseph settles his family in Goshen. Goshen was a rich grazing land, and it was separate from all the other Egyptians and other ethnic peoples down there. So you see, through this, God is protecting the brothers who are willing to intermarry and assimilate. He's protecting them from assimilation by putting them in a place where no one else will really date their sons and daughters. And thus, the story ends with Jacob's 70-person family growing into a large multitude, thousands and thousands of people over the next four centuries. And that's the story of Joseph, greatly edited. Because I wanted to leave time to consider some of the lessons that can be learned from pondering Joseph's stories. I think there are many, many lessons. I mean, think about, for example, the simple lesson for parenting, not to show favoritism to one of your children. Think, for example, about the lesson of fleeing from sexual immorality, which Joseph models when Potiphar's wife tries to seduce him. There are many lessons to be learned from this story, but I want us to look at three lessons, which I think all tie into the rest of what the Bible teaches us and illuminate certain truths that I think are important for us to know if we want to flourish in life. From Joseph's brothers, we get a picture of what it looks like to realize and then to resolve our, what the Bible would call our root problem. We have many problems as fallen people living in a fallen world. And we tend to focus on the problems that are visible and immediately in front of us. We tend to focus especially on the way people treat us. And we tend to focus on the circumstances that befall us. And most of us go through our entire lives assuming that one or both of those problems is our root problem, the real big daddy problem. Whereas God in the Bible, while he always affirms the reality of relational and circumstantial problems, consistently tells us, no, there's a deeper problem that you have. And this deeper problem is the most important one to get resolved. And in fact, resolving this deeper one is going to help you deal with your other problems. And we could call that root problem, and it comes to light in this story, we could call that root problem our true moral guilt before God. Yes, people mistreat us. Yes, circumstances screw us over, etc. But of course, what we tend to forget in the midst of all that is that we're busy screwing people over in varying degrees, and we're busy inflicting bad circumstances on other people in varying degrees. And underlying all of that is the fact that we are in revolt against God, and that we have, because God is a righteous God, we have true objective guilt before God. We're not talking right now about guilt feelings. Guilt feelings are important. And we know also that sometimes our guilt feelings are false guilt. That the way that we're brought up or our personality can lead us to feel guilty about things that aren't even wrong. But that should not obscure, the Bible says, the reality that there's objective guilt that we have before, not only before people, but before the God who made us, and that we're accountable to Him and guilty before Him. Very unpopular message in our culture, which denies the reality of any objective truth, and therefore which denies the reality of any truly objective moral guilt. But his brothers, Joseph's brothers, when they first find themselves in this quandary down in Egypt, begin to express that there's a deeper problem here. Clearly, we're being punished because of what we did to Joseph long ago. They connect the dots that this is not about just misfortune with the famine. This is not about just running into a hard administrator. This has something to do with the guilt that we have before God for what we did to our brother. We saw his anguish when he pleaded for his life and we wouldn't listen. That's why we're in this trouble. It's not karma. Karma is an impersonal, what goes around comes around. They knew that God was a person, not a force. And that they knew that they were beginning to express were guilty before him and were under his judgment. Didn't I tell you not to sin? Oh, there's a snicker word. To sin against the boy? Reuben asks. Now we have to answer for his blood. So what emerges in their consciousness is that the root issue is our guilt before God. And we're accountable to him. And we stand under his judgment. They also... And of course, this is what the Bible says is true of all of us. In Isaiah 59, we read, God's hand is not so short that it cannot save, nor is his ear so dull that it cannot hear. A lot of us go through life raging at how uninvolved God is, how he doesn't, if he's there, he doesn't care. It's like, that's not the root problem. Don't blame it on God. Your iniquities, your moral guilt has made a separation between you and your God, and your sins have hidden his face from you. The reason for that alienation from God lies with us, not with God, as we see in this story and out throughout the Bible. God's the one who's continuing to seek us and hunt us down. But in order for us to be found, we have to come to grips with what the root problem is. Instead of blaming people, circumstances, and God. God, you see a picture of this in this passage. He helps us to realize that our root problem is guilt before him in various ways. He allowed them to experience need through the famine. And if you wind up getting reconciled to God, one of the things that changes very quickly is that you look back on your life about situations of need which you bitterly resented or regretted, and you begin to be thankful for them. Because as someone said, need is the mother of all spiritual receptivity. C.S. Lewis says, suffering is God's megaphone. That's how he rouses a deaf world. And so he sought them and he seeks us through need. He prompts in various ways the memory of our guilt. You see how their arrest by Joseph prompted the memory of the issue that they was most clearly represented their moral guilt. And God will do that for us, not because he's a sadist, not because he loves to rub your nose in what you've done before, but to bring you to a point where you're willing to humble yourself before him. He will remind you of things that you have done and sensitize, prick your conscience about those, in the hopes of jarring you out of your horizontal fixation to think about him and how you've sinned against him. He sure did that in my life in a variety of ways before I got reconciled to him. And he will, for the same reason, to sensitize our conscience. He will show us how our sins negatively affect other people. And you see that very clearly in this story where they just realize, if we have to leave Benjamin here, we're going to break our father's heart. And you know that connected to that was the memory of him, let alone what we've done, what we did years ago that broke our father's heart. I remember right before I came to Christ, going out all night lying to my parents. I was 17, like Joseph was when this story began. And I told them I was going one place and went somewhere else and got stoned all night and caroused and everything. And I came home and my father was there, and he said, he was outside working in the yard, which told me something's wrong because he never works in the yard. And he said to me, "Where were you last night?" And so I lied, and he said, "No, you weren't there, because we called them and they said they never saw you. Where were you?" And I told another lie and another. And I was looking down, trying to come up with how to juggle this. And I remember looking over him. My father was crying. There was a tear coming down his face, which I had never seen before. And he said, "I don't know what to do with you." He said, "I know you're lying, and you know you're lying, and you know that I know you're lying, and still you lie." And that really got to me. I didn't show any response on the spot because I was still trying to manage the consequences. But I just remember being alone after that and just thinking, I can't do this to them. And it was within a few weeks before I met Christ and began a new life with him. God will do that. Because we're so enmeshed in our own self-sufficiency and so self-righteous, so bent on justifying ourselves and blaming others, that it takes blows like this to get our attention. Blows for our good, not for to hurt. We see in this story that they made a critical choice in their response to Joseph, which is a mirror of what the Bible says we can choose with God. They chose to confess their guilt with no excuses and just to cast themselves on his mercy. Judah said, "What can we say to my Lord?" Speaking to Joseph. How can we justify ourselves? If that's a rhetorical question. There's no way. We have no justification for what we've done. God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Behold, we're your slaves. You're just when you judge, and we just accept that. That is what the Bible calls confession and repentance. Jesus told the famous story of the prodigal son to mirror this same critical decision. The son didn't like his dad, so he got his inheritance early, went to the far country, squandered his life in loose living. Finally, he's envying the pods that pigs are eating. And it says in that parable, he finally came to his senses. He finally had a moment of sanity. Have you ever had a moment of sanity? Do you know what sanity looks like? Here's what it looks like first and foremost. He said, "I'll get up and go back to my father. And I'll say to him, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven. I've sinned against God.'" See, he puts that first. "And I've sinned in your sight. Would you even take me back as a slave?" You see, this is humility. This is sanity. Humility is sanity. And then in this story, we see a picture of how God responds to us when we come to him confessing our true moral guilt before him and humbling ourselves. Joseph's response is, "Don't be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here." And he kissed all of his brothers and wept on them. And then they began to relate in a healthy way to each other. Forgiveness and reconciliation. God says in that parable of the prodigal son, so he got up and came to his father, but while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion for him and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son starts to mumble out his memorized apology. Father, I've sinned against heaven and in your sight. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his slaves, there's another but. It's a good but. But the father said to his slaves, quickly bring out the best robe and put it on him and bring out a ring for his hand and sandals for his feet and bring the fattened calf and kill it and let us eat and celebrate. Because this son of mine was dead, but he's come to life again. He was lost, but he's been found. The Father's mercy and compassion is so great that it is the last word of the Father to a humble, repentant son. And so they began to celebrate. And Jesus said, this is what it's like every time one of you changes his mind and comes back to God the way this son does. There's a party that breaks out in heaven between God and the angels when one of you returns in this way. That's the heart of God, not the cosmic killjoy, not the vengeful judge, but the compassionate, forgiving Father who's been pursuing you all along and who's been waiting for you to come to your senses so that he can forgive you and be reconciled to you and begin to remake your life. And we get a picture of that, a beautiful picture of that in the story of Joseph. Paul tells us the reason God can... What about God's righteousness? What about his our true moral guilt? What about his justice? He says, well, the reason why God can appeal to us saying, come back to me the way you are as a sinner is because God made Christ, who never sinned, to be the offering, the payment for our sin, so that we could be made right with God. That's how we can come back to God and receive mercy. That's how God can forgive us and be reconciled to us while even though we're guilty and while we're still unrighteous. I think this leads to a second lesson, which I just want to mention very briefly and tentatively, which is that it seems as though Joseph is a foreshadowing of Jesus in this story. Doesn't say it explicitly. The New Testament doesn't tell us that. So on that level, this is an opinion of mine, not just mine. It wouldn't be surprising because there are so many people and events in the Old Testament that we learn are foreshadowings of the Messiah. But when you think about it, what do we have here? We have Joseph, who was specially loved by his father, who was betrayed and rejected and left for dead by his own people, but who miraculously reappears alive against all odds. And the most important point is that the point of this story is that God all the while was working through their rejection and the suffering, the unjust suffering that fell onto Joseph. He was working through that as the means for delivering the brothers who sold him, as well as for many other people. And so it may well be that this is one of those many prophetic pictures of the career of Jesus in the story of Joseph. Now, I want to end by introducing you to a third lesson, which is critical in our culture especially. And the lesson that we learn here through Joseph is how to thrive in spite of being treated badly by other people. And Joseph was a true victim, victimized by many people in many ways. And one of the things, of course, implicit in this story is that God takes note of that. God cares about his sufferings. And God draws near to him in the midst of his sufferings. But what differentiates Joseph so much from many of us, perhaps, and so many in our culture, is that he did not let his victimization define him. He did not take on what has sometimes been called a victim mentality. And the reason for this is clear throughout the story. The reason for this is that he trusted that not only that God existed, but that God was both a loving, good God and a God who is sovereign, or that is greater than his circumstances. And this is the unique thing about the God of the Bible, both loving and morally good and compassionate and caring and able to care for each individual because he's infinite. And at the same time, sovereign, powerful enough, wise enough to actually make a difference in our lives. And this is the God that Joseph trusted in. And this is what accounts for his ability not only to survive his terrible victimization, but to thrive as a person, even in the midst of it. Jacob, on his deathbed, said that about this about Joseph. Joseph is a fruitful vine. He's a person who bears fruit, a fruitful vine near a spring, whose branches climb over even a wall. You see the elements there? The wall, of course, as the next verses say, represent his adversaries who mistreated him. But he was fruitful even in spite of those barriers, and it was because he was planted by a spring. It's all explained in the next two verses. With bitterness, archers attacked him, metaphorical. They shot at him with hostility, but his bow remained steady. And his strong arm stayed limber. Because why? Because he was awesome. Because of the hand of the mighty one, the sovereign one of Jacob. Because of the shepherd. Because of the rock of Israel. Because of your father's God. That's why he was able to flourish in spite of adversity. He trusted, kept holding on to that promise that God gave him through the dreams. Those dreams told him, you're going to wind up being lifted up. And he kept counting on that in the midst of his darkest days, instead of giving in to despair, instead of giving in to self-pity and complaint. We see how in each situation that he found himself in, even when it was bad and because of ill treatment, he eventually landed on his feet and began to creatively serve in the situation that he was in. And it's clear that it's because of this vertical perspective that God is sovereign. God didn't put me here, but he's allowed me to be here. His promise remains true to flourish my life, so I'm going to be constructive where I am, instead of compromising morally to get out of a bad situation. He obeyed God's ways even when it was costly. Think of Potiphar's wife. The easiest thing to do would have been to give way to her and maybe find a way to consolidate more power in the household. But he said, I'm not going to go against the ways of the one who has promised to be the God of my life and to take care of me. Instead of taking credit for his abilities, which would be the shrewd thing to do when people say, man, you're a great administrator. It's like, you say, you don't know the half of it. He always, in each of those cases, gave the credit to God. He said, God's given me this ability to interpret dreams. God's given me whatever ability that I have to administrate. And maybe most importantly, instead of becoming embittered toward his abusers, that's what will really set your life on fire. Do you know people who have given way to bitterness and resentment, and have you watched how it poisons their lives? I had a family member, an aunt that I grew up, and I just always wondered, what's wrong with her? You could see it on her countenance. And as I came to Christ and as I grew into adulthood, I realized she's bitter. And she was bitter. And someone really had screwed her over. She never set that person free from paying them back herself. And you know, that's the thing about bitterness. You stay bitter because you think they deserve justice, and they do. And if I don't give them, if I don't punish them, who will? But the thing about it is then that very attitude begins to destroy and disintegrate you as a person. Makes you crazy. When the dust settles, I wonder how many people in our culture are mentally in bad shape primarily because of bitterness and resentment towards other people. It'll kill you. And Joseph, and you could see in our narrative, it was not without a struggle. The pain that he felt when he saw his brothers that speared his heart so bad that he had to get out of the room. He wrestled to land on forgiveness. But he did land there. And his statement at the end of the narrative, where they're like, are you sure now that our dad Jacob's dead? You sure now that you're not going to kill us now for what we did? He said, am I God that I can punish you? That's not my job. To pay people back for what they've done to you is to usurp the role of Almighty God, which is a greater sin than what they've done to you. Furthermore, you intended to harm me, but God, who's sovereign and loving, worked through this same situation for my good. He brought me into this position so that I could help other people. There's the real basis for forgiveness, is this trust in a loving, sovereign God. And so I choose instead to continue to take care of you. There's the outworking of forgiveness into constructive, redemptive treatment of the people who have mistreated us. You say, well, that all sounds simple in theory. It's not simple, and it's not easy. And you need a big God to enable you to forgive people who have really messed you over. But on the other hand, if you don't lay hold of him and trust him and let him teach you how to forgive the people who have screwed you over, you're going to become a slave to your own bitterness. And that's where Joseph really proves to be a hero right there. Joseph thrived, even though he was victimized probably in greater ways than anyone in this room has been victimized. Not to demean in any way the suffering of your victimization. And you can thrive too, no matter how you've been victimized, if you learn to trust this God who's sovereign and loving, and let him teach you in these bullets that we just went through how to land on that trust. All right, I'm going to close this in prayer because we're out of time. Lord, just thank you for the chance to study this whole book of Genesis, some sections more closely than others. Thank you for these long narratives and the way that you're able to instruct us and convict us and persuade us in deep ways through narrative. We thank you this morning for learning about the fact that you're a loving and sovereign God. You keep your promises. You're pursuing us. You are there to strengthen us. And that, thank you for telling us that our lives are ultimately about your purpose rather than our own selfish demands. We praise you for that. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.